from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Montgomery, and today for Mina Kim. Since the Nuremberg trials, the United States has often been at the forefront of holding war criminals accountable and fighting genocide. But some critics wonder whether the war on terror has undermined America's moral authority. A new book, Hiding in Plain Sight, examines that tension as it traces the dramatic pursuit of fugitive war criminals from World War II to the present day. We talked to two of the book's authors. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Mina Kim. At Nuremberg, the United States led the way in creating a legal framework for holding war criminals accountable and fighting genocide. In the 1990s, that concept was revived in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. But in the war on terror, the United States has taken a different approach. And critics say this has undermined the legacy of Nuremberg and the nation's moral authority. A new book, Hiding in Plain Sight, examines this tension as it traces the dramatic pursuit of fugitive war criminals from World War II to the present day. We're going to talk with two of the book's authors. We're joined today by Eric Stover, faculty director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley School of Law, and Alexa Koenig, executive director of UC Berkeley's Human Rights Center. They co-wrote with Victor Peskin, Hiding in Plain Sight, The Pursuit of War Criminals from Nuremberg to the War on Terror. I just want to first thank both of you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
So I want to ask you, perhaps go to you first, Eric. Your book covers more than 70 years of history. It begins at Nuremberg, as we said, and there's a lot of things I want to get into in that history. What was your thinking behind sort of bookending the book with Nuremberg and the War on Terror? Some people, I think, would consider that a little provocative. I found it a great way to get through this topic. But what was your thinking behind sort of structuring it that way?
Well, it goes back to 1945, and it goes back to 1945. And as I'm sure listeners know, there were the Nuremberg trials, the Tokyo trials. I mean, there was really an effort to develop principles around international criminal justice, where there would be fair trials, and war crime suspects would be brought to trial. After that, about 1952 or so, international criminal justice went into the deep freeze, but it came back out in the 1990s.
We had the Cold War, of course.
Cold War, establishment of various tribunals, still seeking the principles of international criminal justice, which is a fair trial and prosecution, defense, working on cases. Well, what we saw with the War on Terror was after 9/11, a lot of those rules got flipped over, and we were no longer, at least the United States, was not following those international declarations and conventions that it had signed, particularly in the Geneva Conventions and the suspension of how we treated prisoners of war. So for us, the question was always, first of all, before you can have a trial, you actually need to have an accused. So the pursuit is, how do you go after those war crime suspects? And when you look in the post 9/11 environment, we're looking at going after suspected terrorists. And how did the United States conduct that pursuit? And was it illegal or was it legal? And that's, we wanted to explore that topic.
Right. And I mean, we have heard the phrase in terms of going after terrorists, capture or kill. It seems like, especially with the use of drones, we're losing the first notion of capturing and really just heading straight to the killing. And we can get into that later. But certainly, I think it's interesting to look at the principles of Nuremberg and the efforts the United States put into that, and, you know, sort of in the context or comparing that to what we've seen since 9/11. Alexa, what else went into thinking about framing the book in that way?
You know, I think one thing that we found pretty early on as we were doing this research is that if our question on the table was, how do you get the most egregious war criminals behind bars when there are a lot of political reasons why countries may not want to see that happen, that there were really three things that kept popping up. One was that you need a strong legal framework, so you need the legal authority to actually go after them, extradite them when that needs to happen, and to get them into a court of law. You need the operational advantage. You need to be able to track these people, and we've talked to tracking teams around the world about what tactics do they put in place to find people when people are actually hiding. But the third, and what we kept finding was one of the most important, was political will. How do you actually muster the political will to have countries aid in the search for these individuals, or when they are, as our book is called, hiding in plain sight, so they're right in front of us, how do you break down the political protections around them to make them vulnerable enough to get them into courts?
And you write throughout the book about how political will waxes and wanes. And that goes back all the way to Nuremberg. I mean, there was not initially a consensus to put all the Nazi leaders on trial. I mean, it's been written that Winston Churchill thought, or some British leader, that they should just line them up and shoot them, execute them, and get it over with. That was not the direction they went. But this has always been a sort of debate in these areas.
Well, going back to 1945, and that's the first Nuremberg trial of the high-ranking civilian leaders of the Third Reich, and then you had subsequent trials after that. There were quite a few trials, but by you get to 1950, 1951, there was an unease as to whether these trials were undermining the morale of the German public. And so shouldn't we really be focusing on the Soviet menace? And so the feeling was to pull back and stop holding these trials. And when the Germans took over the sovereignty of their country again in the end of 1949, there were essentially no trials for years and years. And eventually trials began again more into the 60s. But so you had this pursuit, this political interest, and then this feeling we have to pull back and stop demoralizing the German population.
And that leads to a section in your book which, is probably familiar to some of our listeners. It was familiar to me, nevertheless, eye-popping and troubling. And that is when we get into the Cold War and the relationship, if you will, between U.S. intelligence agencies, U.S. intelligence operatives, and former Nazi intelligence agents, military leaders. And you show how these relationships develop, leading to Nazis being able to get out of Europe, go to South America on what was called the Rat Line, also getting the United States. And we're going to get into this a little bit with another guest, but set that up a little bit for us, Eric, in terms of what was going on by the 1950s in terms of some of these Nazi, at that point, former Nazis, and how they were treated by, elements of the U.S. government?
So, again, it all goes back to 1945. It's the Americans and their allies. Not only did they decide to hold trials, but they were also going to set up a denazification program. And that would be looking at members of the Nazi Party and whether they should be brought to trial and punished or in some ways censored. And that process through the Counterintelligence Corps, which was the military's intelligence in the U.S. Army, began looking for those Nazi Party members, also recruiting some of them for intelligence purposes. And some of those that they recruited were, in fact, war criminals. And so they were caught in a situation where when it was found out that, and this happened in the Klaus Barbie case, they needed to get them out of the country. And we do know there were a few cases in which the rat lines were used.
Right. Well, I want to go a little bit further into that. And we're now going to check in with a real Nazi hunter. Alan Ryan is the former director of the Office of Special Investigations in the Criminal Division of the U.S. Justice Department. And that's where he was responsible for the investigation and prosecution of Nazi war criminals in the U.S. Welcome to Forum, Alan Ryan.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for joining us. I want to get into a little bit further into the Klaus Barbie case, which you know a lot about. But I want to ask you something a little more sort of broader than that. about this era. And I want to ask you this, Mr. Ryan. What do we know today that we didn't know back in the 1970s or perhaps 1980s about the role of U.S. intelligence agents and others in protecting Nazi officials, former Nazi officials, and in getting them out of Europe to South America and United States? I realize you could write multiple books about that.
Let me stop you right there.
Sure.
First of all, I was not a Nazi hunter. I was a federal prosecutor. Secondly, I had a little difficulty hearing Eric and Alexa in the last few minutes, but I think a distinction has to be drawn between the fact that U.S. intelligence, mostly the Army Counterintelligence Corps, did use former Nazis as informants in Europe because we were essentially trying to figure out what the communists were going to do. And in the Klaus Barbie case, that was unusual because Barbie was a senior Nazi official in Lyon. He was the head of the SS in Lyon, France. And when the French asked if the U.S. Intelligence agencies knew where he was or could give them any clue so that they could put him on trial, the Army basically lied and said, we don't know anything about him. And then they sent him off by the rat line that the Vatican was running to South America. He never came to the United States. That I think that distinction has to be made. What we did was an obstruction of justice. I issued a report to the Attorney General back in the 1980s, basically saying that it was an obstruction of justice and that we owed an apology to France, which the Secretary of State then issued later my report. But I think generally there's an assumption that Nazis came to the United States because U.S. intelligence agencies brought them here. And by and large, that's not true. The truth, I think, is much more sobering, which is that we allowed them to come in here because it was very easy to lie about their past. Most of them, in fact, were not Germans. They were Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, Ukrainians. They were Nazi collaborators during the occupation of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
And so when you came in the Office of Special Investigations, talk a little bit about the challenge you faced at that time. And remind me, at what point in time are we at when you came in?
Well, the Office of Special Investigations was created in 1979 because nothing had been done to investigate Nazis who had come to this country in the 34 years after World War II, most of those between 1948 and 1952. And frankly, we didn't know the first thing about how we went about finding Nazi war criminals in the United States. But as it turned out, it wasn't that hard. There were immigration records of names. We had access through European archives to rosters of the SS and punitive battalions and other places, units that carried out war crimes. So it was a fairly tedious and not very exciting process, matching up names of war criminals to names of people who would come to the United States. And once we had a match there, it was fairly easy to find. Our cases that were brought against them were that they had come to this country illegally. Those who had become naturalized citizens had obtained that illegally because being a Nazi was a disqualifying condition. And we brought a number of cases in federal courts where federal judges listened to the evidence and were persuaded and revoked their citizenship.
And they were deported?
Most of them were. That was a separate bridge we had to cross because losing your citizenship doesn't mean that you're deported. There has to be another country that's willing to take you back. And Germany was fairly reluctant in that regard.
So following that work, the historical record started opening up. After you left the office, Mr. Ryan, we started learning more about this period of time in the 50s, and how some of these Nazi officials were able to escape. And if I'm not mistaken, that record became quite public, and I think the U.S. was praised for kind of making public some things that perhaps officials at the time would not have wanted public. And just to switch to Eric for a moment, that is an element in your book.
Of opening up.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we need to be open about what happened in these cases. And transparency is fundamental. And I think what was also important by learning the fact that, as Alan Ryan was saying, you know, it isn't that Nazi war criminals were being funneled into the United States on a rat line, but there was a process called Operation Paperclip. And it all fit into the Cold War mentality, and that is that the Americans were concerned that the Soviets could get a hold of some of the V-2 rocket technology, and they wanted to get these engineers and scientists into the United States. So they were brought in. As Alan Ryan knows well, I think somewhere around 1600 or so, and some of those were Nazi war criminals, or they had been in factories where there was slave labor and so on. So bringing this open, we understand better about how our intelligence services worked for our good and against our good.
Mr. Ryan, go ahead, sorry.
What Eric says is true. Operation Paperclip was an effort that was successful by and large to recruit German rocket scientists before the Soviets could get their hands on them. And at least one that we investigated and who admitted his role, Arthur Rudolph, was later deported. If we had started sooner, I'm sure we could have just found more. Many of them died by the 1980s.
And just last question to you, Mr. Ryan. When you went about your work, again, as the first director, did you have sort of general cooperation from other federal agencies? You said, you know, getting some of the information was relatively easy once you were able to focus on it. But what was the sort of general attitude of the United States government at the time?
Well, before I took the job, I told the Attorney General that we absolutely had to have the cooperation of the CIA, the military, and all branches of the United States government, because otherwise we'd be on a fool's errand. And he agreed completely. We met with the CIA officials, and we did have full access. Most of these files that we needed to look at had never been opened in 25 years. So it was not exactly a hot issue. And we did have full cooperation. More than that, we had the cooperation of most European governments, which was an enormous help.
And this work continues. I mean, there is a couple of offices in the federal government that are tasked with, looking for war criminals, people who have lied about their record in other countries in the United States. I mean, it's still an active job, if you will.
Well, not only that, most of the Nazis are dead, but there are no shortage of human rights violators throughout the world, some of whom may attempt to come to the United States. And what the Justice Department is doing now, sort of the successor to our office, is bringing the same standards of inspection and vetting and prohibiting visas to human rights violators, which, of course, is what we should have done starting in 1945.
All right. Alan Ryan, thanks for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Alan Ryan is the former director of the Office of Special Investigations in the Criminal Division of the U.S. Justice Department. As he points out, he was not a Nazi hunter, but he did help bring Nazis to justice and get them deported. I want to go back to you, Eric, and back to this period of history, the Cold War, where a lot of this stuff was put on hold. And then we enter the 1990s. There's genocide in Rwanda, war in Yugoslavia, and there's a push to create a new type of tribunal based on Nuremberg's principles. Where did that push come from?
I think it really, really comes down to the thawing of the Cold War and the fact that the United States and the Soviet Union had hegemonic power over so many countries. And with the thawing of the Cold War, that influence, that stepping back, started to take place, and it really began in Latin America. And that's where you see in Argentina, in 1984, civilian government comes to power, and Raul Alfonsín, the president, orders that there will be a trial of the military junta. And that's the first domestic trial we're seeing in years. And he holds the trial. And really, that's kind of the – I think that's the juggernaut of justice beginning. It then goes through truth commissions throughout Latin America, South Africa. We see it in the Far East. We have lustration programs in Eastern Europe to look at members of the Communist Party who had committed crimes. And then, of course, we have the genocide and the war crimes that took place in the former Yugoslavia.
And so we move to a criminal.
We move to a criminal. And more
approach.
Of an international perspective, where the UN decides it is time to establish a tribunal, an international tribunal, that will look at the alleged crimes that took place during the Yugoslavia conflict. And they set up the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Unfortunately, the UN did not fund it properly, and it took years before it could really get on its feet and do the proper work that it should be doing.
And, you know, I think I met you 20-some years ago when you were literally in the trenches in the Balkans investigating atrocities. And one of the things you write about in the book is, I think, a challenge facing investigators that some readers might not think about, and that is the different groups you have to navigate and negotiate with on the ground. You had peacekeepers. You sometimes have NATO forces. You have the local forces, some of whom maybe committed some of these crimes. And that you were in that, sort of in that situation in the Balkans, in Croatia, I believe, back in the day.
Yes. Well, it was I was taking in with a forensic anthropologist, Clyde Snow. The two of us were taking in teams to investigate the mass graves, and we were doing this for the court. And the difficulty was the NATO. Dayton Accords were signed in the end of 1995. We go in with teams in 1996, but we couldn't get troops to protect the grave sites. Even Western troops were too nervous to do that. So you always have these constant challenges of carrying out the investigations and working with the families and making sure that you're collecting evidence that will actually end up bringing the leaders, those most responsible, to justice.
And just briefly, as we've seen in other places, it's not like the peacekeepers are necessarily that interested in getting to the bottom of some of these crimes. You know, as we've seen in Kosovo, there was a concern about, you know, undermining stability, especially when your partner is, one of the former groups that was fighting. But there's that kind of pressure.
Well, I think we were all of us on a learning curve, not only those.
I thought you were going to say on a short leash.
On a short leash, but on a learning curve. And so were the troops. But they eventually found out that they could do this.
We will continue our conversation about the pursuit of Nazis and other war criminals. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments at forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Mina Kim, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Mina Kim. We're discussing the pursuit of war criminals. Our guests are Eric Stover, faculty director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley School of Law, and Alexa Koenig, executive director of UC Berkeley's Human Rights Center. They co-wrote with Victor Peskin the book Hiding in Plain Sight, The Pursuit of War Criminals from Nuremberg to the War on Terror. And Alexa, I want to go to you. The Human Rights Center, you do a lot more than give lectures and write books. You are also investigators out in the world. Talk to me a little bit about that role that you play and that the Human Rights Center plays.
Thanks. One of the things that I think we really try and do at the Human Rights Center is to build on this longstanding work that Eric helped pioneer around how to help courts, if they're going to take on and tackle some of the highest level, you know, war crimes perpetrators and try to bring them to justice, how do we make sure that they can do their job effectively? The stakes are so high when you have people who have been accused of committing genocide and other mass crimes. If the courts indict them and ultimately the case fails to go forward, those individuals are returned to their communities. Individuals who've testified against them could be at risk. Their family members could be at risk. How do we minimize that? So whenever you have one of these high-profile cases, one of the things you really want to do is get all three kinds of evidence you can and hopefully corroborate that evidence so that you have as strong a case as you possibly can have going forward. You need the witnesses to come in and talk about what they've seen and experienced. You need the physical evidence, so the bones that are unearthed from the grave sites, the guns that were used in killings. And then you also need documentary evidence. So the records that have been put together about who did what to whom and when. So one of the things that we've been trying to help with is that as these international criminal tribunals have been developed, first in the 1990s with Eric's assistance.
In Yugoslavia and Rwanda.
Exactly. And now with the International Criminal Court and its growing importance on the international stage, how do we make sure they can do their jobs effectively and efficiently? One of the things that we've been trying to help with is their investigations of sexual violence crimes. Rape and sexual violence are relatively new in terms of being recognized as crimes internationally.
I think Bosnia was the first time, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Exactly. And so how do we get evidence of such sensitive issues where there are cultural barriers to that and also just really pragmatic barriers? So we have a sexual violence program that was looking at the Hassan Habre trial and trying to figure out, bringing together a number of experts internationally who could talk about kind of sexual violence in that case.
That was in Chad, correct?
That's correct. Right. And then also looking at the Bemba case, which is at the International Criminal Court. That was a case where it was the first time in the International Criminal Court that there's been a conviction for sexual violence-related crimes.
In Congo.
I believe so.
Yes.
Right.
And then the other thing is one thing we've really specialized in is figuring out how new technologies can be brought to bear on war crimes investigations, starting with the DNA work that Eric, you know, did back with the former Yugoslavia.
And which they pioneered in Bosnia.
Exactly. And then now with open source investigations. So one of the things that we're finding today is that one of the biggest hurdles for these international tribunals is connecting the crimes that are happening on the ground to the highest level perpetrators, the presidents, the commanders, et cetera.
And you write a lot about this in the book, is how to get the big fish.
Exactly. And you need to draw that chain of connection from those crimes all the way up to the top. One of the best ways that we can do that today is actually using social media to try and show the links between individuals. Obviously, a lot of our communication today is happening over cell phones. It's happening through platforms like Facebook or Twitter. And we can now begin to draw those links by using smart techniques to mine those platforms for information.
Can you give an example or a hypothetical on how that might play out?
Well, one example would be there might be individuals who are tweeting about their activity where they really want to announce, for example, terrorists who may want to announce it and take responsibility for horrific crime and are trying to actually use social media to broadcast what they're doing.
Which ISIS has obviously done.
Absolutely.
To almost perfection, actually. They promote their atrocities on Twitter.
Exactly. And there was actually an incident recently where you had a number of individuals who were, you know, kind of applauding one of the big events that we've had recently, and they were holding up signs around the world basically lauding this behavior. And some of the best open source investigators were able to actually use the images that were posted to social media to figure out where those individuals were, and they were able to start to pinpoint individuals within the network based on those images.
And that brings to mind, I believe it was work that Human Rights Watch did in either Syria or Iraq, where they used social media to pinpoint locations of mass graves or where mass shootings occurred. And I think some of that information came through social media. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a real thing. I mean, the International Criminal Court and the prosecutors and investigators are really trying to get a handle on this.
It's a new technique.
With your help.
hopefully we can help. We'll see how much help we can be. But there are certainly organizations around the world that have pioneered some of this work. Storyful in Ireland, Bellingcat is another one who's done some phenomenal work. But it's this idea of triangulating evidence, bringing together all the resources we have and being creative about how we can build a case. Everything from satellite imagery and mapping that onto the pictures that are going across Facebook and Twitter, YouTube, et cetera, and ultimately building the story of what's happened.
Well, I want to ask you about the International Criminal Court. It came online in 2002. We don't really hear that. You hear a lot about it, but I think in the media here, and certainly in like the presidential campaign, no one talks about the International Criminal Court. There was a lot of hope invested in the court back when it was created in the run-up. I think there was a lot of feeling that once the court came online, that it would not only help deal with serious atrocities and the people responsible, but also have a kind of deterrent effect. But of course, that happened just as just after 9/11, and we had a very changing landscape. And I want to get into that, the 9/11 landscape, post 9/11 landscape. But just generally, is it unfair to say that the performance of the court so far has been a disappointment?
You know, I think that's a tricky question because I sometimes think our expectations are a little off from what to anticipate with courts. As Eric mentioned earlier, it took a while for the Yugoslavia Tribunal, which is now broadly heralded as having been a success, to get up and off the ground. And one of the reasons behind that was a lack of funding. With the International Criminal Court, I think it's facing a couple of major challenges. One is that unlike at Nuremberg, when they're doing investigations around the world, they often don't have control over the territories in which they're conducting the investigations, which means they're really at the mercy of states to help them get access to the information they need to prosecute these crimes. And of course, this is where political will potentially becomes an impediment. If you're going after the president of a country and you're trying to get evidence from that country, there are logically going to be roadblocks to getting that information. The second dependency on states is for funding. So the way the International Criminal Court has been set up, nations ultimately, ratify the Rome Statute, which is the body of laws on which the court was founded, and they kind of sign in or opt in to the court. As part of that, they have the obligation to give the court a budget. And unfortunately, relative to the other tribunals and the scope of their mandate, the budget that they have is incredibly small. We have a colleague at the center who's made the kind of analogy, and I think it's a brilliant one, that the budget for the Office of the Prosecutor is about analogous to that of the city of Berkeley. And to think that the territory they have to cover is potentially the globe and around some of the most serious crimes and the highest level perpetrators, I think we have a bit of a disjunct there.
And of course, a big deal too is that United States, China, Russia have not signed on to the court. I think in your book, you describe the United States as I think at best a fair weather friend of the court. At times, been willing to help out. They supported referring the case of the Sudanese president al-Bashir to the court, which would not have had direct jurisdiction. But other times, as you write about, especially early on in the Bush administration, really actively trying to sabotage the court.
Well, and this, Michael, and this, that taps into the central theme of the book, and this is this whole waxing and waning. So we're excited. We established the International Criminal Court. It has state party members, so countries become members of the court. You have an arrest warrant issued 7 years ago for al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, and there are countries, state parties to the court that are supposed to arrest him when he steps onto their soil. And we know seven of those state parties have allowed him to travel to their countries and not arrest him. So there's a responsibility there. And that's what's been lacking. It's a sort of waxing and waning. We support it, then we back off.
And we are talking about the pursuit of war criminals from Nuremberg to the war on terror. Our guests, Eric Stover and Alexa Koenig, they are both with the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center. Also want to add that Victor Peskin also was a co-author in their book, Hiding in Plain Sight. I want to move into the war on terror. One of the things you write about in the book are efforts to bring criminal charges, criminal cases against the so-called Bush Six. These were largely by groups in Europe. But I want to ask you, you do go into this a little bit, but if you were a prosecutor tasked with building a case against the U.S. for war crimes or crimes against humanity. And this is a hypothetical. But if you were asked to do that, where would you focus?
One of the things that I think we've said repeatedly and that does come up in the book is the importance of conducting objective investigations. As Eric mentioned earlier in the segment, it is so important to have the facts of what has taken place. And that is really something that helped us develop the body of law that would allow us to have successful prosecutions at Yugoslavia, at Rwanda, coming out of Nuremberg, as we understood during the Cold War what had happened, and then increasingly got access to records about crimes that have been committed. That's something we have yet to have. There have been obviously some investigations, when some of the scandals at Abu Ghraib were broken open. There was obviously a lot in the media at the time about torture that had been committed against detainees. There were some investigations of that particular incident, but really understanding what the law says is right and wrong. And then what people did. When you have a successful prosecution, you need two things. You need to be able to prove that something illegal was actually physically committed, but you also need to prove what's called the mens rea, which is the ideas in the people's head, that they had the intent to commit that crime. And for every crime, that there's a different standard of intent. Until we really have documented what happened, who were the actors involved, and what they intended, it's going to be very hard to have successful prosecutions.
Yeah, I would mention back in 2006, we did a study at the Human Rights Center. Alex and I were involved in it, and Laurel Fletcher, who's a colleague of ours at the law school. We went out and interviewed 62 former Guantanamo detainees in nine different countries. And at that point in time, we knew very little about what had happened to Guantanamo inside the prison itself. And so we went out and interviewed the 62 former Guantanamo detainees. We were ready to publish our report right before the elections in 2008, but we waited till after the election because we didn't want it to come out at a time when people were going to the ballot. And we waited because we wanted to make a recommendation, and that was that given what we had learned and what others were learning about what had happened under the War on Terror, the black sites that were established where people were taken and clearly waterboarded and tortured, so how do we investigate this? And we recommended, as did many others organizations, was that there be a blue ribbon panel established that would have intelligence, legal personnel, and others on the people from civil society who would look into the charges and look into the evidence and decide where it should go. And unfortunately, with the Obama administration, there was no effort to do that. And so we're still left with this question that, yes, at Abu Ghraib, the infamous prison in Iraq, there were some of the guards who were held accountable for it, but you hit a ceiling. And at that point, we know higher-level personnel in the U.S. government intelligence had knowledge, and that should be investigated at some point.
And you've seen a lot has been written about the various memos that were written to President Bush that argued that the techniques that were used on some of these detainees, which I think many people would consider torture, that those were legal. In other words, from Bush's perspective, he got legal advice saying that what they were doing was okay. I want to get to a comment. Mason asks, currently John Yoo, author of the Bush era so-called torture memos, holds the Emanuel S. Heller Chair at UC Berkeley School of Law. What does Yoo's academic position at UC Berkeley say about American accountability for committing torture and associate war crimes? Any thoughts on that question?
Well, again, I think it goes back to the need to actually have facts. And as someone who's a lawyer and who is really interested in the careful evolution of law and accountability for war crimes, I think until you have those facts, you really can't make a determination. Courts are set up for a reason, and investigations are set up for a reason. What I'd personally like to see is some of these files be opened and have a little bit more transparency about what's occurred.
That's absolutely – we saw it with the Senate torture report that came out several years ago. We learned so much from that report, but it was so redacted as well. And that's why we need a thorough, transparent – if you go back to what Alan Ryan did, Alan Ryan, as we learned earlier in the hour, was able to go into the CIA files to see what relationship did intelligence services have with this guy, Klaus Barbie, who was put on a rat line and sent down to Latin America. And we need greater, more thorough transparency to pull, as Alexa says, the facts and set them out here and then follow the train of evidence. And if there is criminal responsibility, there looks to be, then there should be accountability.
And another thing you write in your book and mention in your book is the increasing use of drones mm-hmm. for what I would call targeted assassinations. Does that also raise further questions and take us further away from this sort of Nuremberg legacy? I mean, we've talked about this before, Alexa, but what are your thoughts on that?
I have a couple. One is that, again, just like the issue of whether torture has been committed in the war on terror, and I think many people would say that it has been, we need more transparency around the legal framework that's being developed. And that's what concerns me most, is that the United States has obviously been a leader in the use of drones in terms of the technologies that are being developed, but has also used it more than any other country. As more and more countries begin to use drones, we need a legal framework in place and transparency around decision making for when drones are appropriately used. When do they actually cost fewer lives than alternative mechanisms for reaching some of our policy objectives? And that's a pretty broad call at the moment.
Right. I want to go to a caller who's been waiting very patiently. I appreciate that. Rama in Fairfax, you have a question going back to World War II, post-World War II Germany. Rama, you are on forum.
Okay. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, actually, hearing the discussion, my question is going a little bit into the present now. And my question, and what I'm not feeling good about, is let's say we're saying that the Nazis were afraid to demoralize the German population by prosecuting Nazis. That's been said, right?
Correct. Yeah. Right.
Okay, I have a problem then that we're so critical of someone like Vladimir Putin, and we're not worried that we're perhaps demoralizing the Russian people, and we were very hard on Saddam Hussein. We had him killed, and that really demoralized the people in Iraq, and some of those people have become terrorists and now are fighting against us. So it seems that perhaps we're our own worst enemies in some ways.
All right. Thank you for your question. There's a couple different questions there. You mentioned this in your book, actually, and I don't think the caller was particularly pleased with the way Saddam Hussein was treated. But he was put on trial, unlike Osama bin Laden. And you contrast those two approaches. I mean, there have been trials, actually, and there's been an attempt at trials in Guantanamo Bay. But you do contrast this, and we don't need to get into the whole killing of bin Laden, but I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
On Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
Yes. Well, what we try and do is with Saddam Hussein is we tell the story of his capture and the way that he was captured, and we're contrasting that with the use of black sites, which was a different process. The process of capturing Saddam Hussein was a military operation. He, as far as we know, was not abused, being taken into custody. Now, when it comes to the trial, that's a very different issue. That's not to say that we would endorse necessarily how the trial was held.
Right, but the capture was in the spirit of the post-World War II Germany. I mean, they sent out intelligence agencies searching for Nazis. These aren't the ones who escaped, but the ones who were captured. Since the Western forces were occupying Germany, that wasn't quite as hard.
Yeah, and the point is that throughout history, there have been military operations that have made arrests, including in Bosnia and other countries, which were done properly. That's what is the shocking factor after 9/11 by setting up these black sites.
One of the things that I found fascinating in researching the book is looking at 9/11 as a pivot point. So you see from World War II going underground during the Cold War and then through the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, this strengthening and evolution of international norms and international law. 9/11, there's a fork in the road. And you ultimately see policy objectives of the United States government being played out along those two different paths. And I think what's fascinating about Saddam Hussein is it's an attempt to continue along the path of using courts as a mechanism for having results that the country is seeking. But then the other is something that went really underground and I think was a very shadowy path. And it was this idea that there are risks to being transparent and that we need to – I think there's the infamous quote about taking the gloves off and doing everything that's needed to fight this war against terror. And what Osama bin Laden represents in the book is this taking of another path.
And does Guantanamo represent that as well?
It does. I mean, the fact that you have over 700 men, close to 800 men, who are basically taken and put in a place where they have very little access to reporters, very little voice. In the beginning, did not have access to attorneys. I think, again, it's that silencing of and the non-transparency. Thank goodness for a lot of really great reporting that has helped bring a lot of these issues to light and have helped us to better understand what our policy choices were after 9/11 and how we implemented them.
And yet, in spite of what President Obama promised to mm-hmm. close the prison in Guantanamo, it's still open. There are still detainees there. Do you expect that it could be closed or will be closed by the next president of the United States, whoever that is?
That's a hard call. I think what is promising is how many men now have been released. What I think has been underexplored is what happens with those men after they're released and how the United States is or is not working with them to make sure that you can never compensate, of course, if someone is found, if there's insufficient evidence to actually try them and, you know, 10 years, 15 years of their life have been taken away. But what do we need to do to better make sure that our national security needs are met long term and that we're meeting the needs of these individuals who we ultimately, in some cases, just flat out made a mistake in locking up?
Eric, any thoughts on that?
Well, I want to go back and also point out that at Guantanamo, when we did our study of former Guantanamo detainees, we also interviewed some interrogators and others who personnel who had worked at the camp. And I was always struck by one interrogator, and he said, you know, it made my day when I saw one of these guys leave. And this was the problem. They rushed in these prisoners. They hadn't done adequate checks, and then they found they were in trouble and they had to release them without charging them and taking them to trial.
I mean, there has been talk about moving the detainees, inmates, to a prison in the United States. That's been blocked. Any realistic chances of that?
Possibly. I think one of the concerns among some of the people that I've talked with who are representing some of the detainees is that if you bring them to the United States, in some ways you bring even less attention to what's going on at Guantanamo. Guantanamo has helped motivate a lot of the fact-finding and understanding of what our response has been. So to bring them to the mainland, I'm not concerned about the security piece. If you look at Guantanamo and how the prison was set up, it's an exact replica in sections of it of supermax prisons here in the United States. So I think we are completely competent as a nation to actually make sure that security needs are met. It's the political piece, again, which is this recurring theme in the book, that will ultimately decide what happens.
And if we, the West, NATO, were to defeat ISIS tomorrow and all of a sudden we had 5,000 or 10,000 detainees, captives, are we prepared to deal with that on a legal front? I mean, do we have the framework? Do we have an approach? How would that play out?
Well, if you're talking about setting up a tribunal, that's going to be very difficult, and that's what you learn. You cannot try necessarily 5,000 individuals in one court. That's not going to happen. So it's going to have to be a process, a vetting process to decide who you actually bring to court. And that's what happened after World War II. There were prison camps, and decisions were made who were actually going to be brought to trial. And you're going after those who are most high-ranking, who committed the most serious crimes. And I would imagine that's what's going to – the focus is going to be on.
You know, there's a counterpoint in your book which isn't specifically about ISIS, but it's this sort of warning about the kind of danger of the hunt, if you will. If we treat some of these suspects in certain ways, we're going to end up being too aggressive in the way we go after them. Remind me, that I think comes up in the context of former Yugoslavia, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was really the fact that one of the prosecutors, Luis Arbour, started using sealed indictments. And sealed indictments are that there is an indictment for someone to be arrested, but it's not made public. And that way you can surprise them and capture them. And it's in that point of capture, and afterwards you just have to be careful that they are not ill-treated, they're given their rights. And that's a critical point, that you don't get overzealous in this pursuit of war crime suspects.
I want to go to a caller, Helene Ma from San Jose. Question about what's being done to deal with war crimes that are happening in Afghanistan and being overlooked. Hi there. You are on Forum.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a journalist. I cover human rights issues, and I spent over 10 years covering Afghanistan. And I had a question about the war crimes that are being overlooked in Afghanistan and were overlooked immediately after 9/11 because it benefited the U.S. and allies to partner with war criminals and actually offer them help in creating protections for themselves, such as an amnesty law. And that was very much driven by U.S. consultants and projects and allies. And so I wanted to ask your thoughts. Those people are still sitting in government positions and in parliament in Afghanistan.
Okay. I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you for your question. Thoughts briefly?
I think one of the most important things to keep in mind when we look at international criminal accountability is the need to play a long game. Because politics does play such a seminal role in who ultimately receives justice in a court of law and who doesn't, we need to be thinking about all the strategies to create the vulnerabilities to ultimately get accountability. And that's everything from journalists doing the kind of expose that they do to civil society groups who are uncovering facts and building momentum and political will to go after these people. And the survivors themselves telling their stories so we know what's happened.
All right. Well, we are going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Eric Stover, Faculty Director of Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley School of Law, and Alexa Koenig, Executive Director of the Human Rights Center, co-authors with Victor Peskin of Hiding in Plain Sight. Thanks, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you for having
us.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schoeffer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Montgomery, in for Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.